Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 209. Je suis priest. Is that how you pronounce this?
You know, there's the modern way. I think it's je suis priest.
Je suis priest?
I think. I'm sure if Guillaume, our French coach, was here, he would correct both of us.
Je suis priest or something. Anyway, I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and I'm happy to be joined by the writer of this particular episode, Matt Roberts.
Hello, everyone.
Well, this was the beginning of our war story here in season two. I think it was always going to be the beginning of the war story, right? This and all.
There we go.
Okay.
It's still a little, we had a little technical issue.
It's two knuckleheads trying to figure out volume levels. So
too many knobs and toggles.
But what do you want? We're still in the main title, so it did take that one. Anyway, the beginning of the Jacobite Rebellion is really in this episode.
Yeah, this is where they actually get down to the training of the men, and we kind of see Jamie becoming. We've talked about it a lot, but the leader of men, and we wanted to, I know we talked about it in the room a lot, we wanted to actually show it instead of talk about it.
Now, structurally, I don't think we ever talked about doing, like, the Battle of Falkirk. When we were setting up the season, didn't we kind of zero in quickly on, we said we'll do Prestonpans and the beginning of Culloden, but basically we weren't going to do any of the other sort of skirmishes and battles, right?
No, we had to... pun intended, we had to pick our battles because to create just a skirmish is a 2 or 3 day event, filming wise. So we had to, since we went all out in the next episode, we had to kind of find a way of doing battles without doing battles, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, people always talk about why is there so much more action in films than there is in television? Why can't you have a really action-packed TV show? It's mostly time. It's not even so much money. I mean, money equals time, but TV shows have to be shot much, much faster than feature films. We just don't have the time to spend... I mean, they would take days just to shoot, like, you know, one stunt and on a feature schedule.
And we, during the block, so 209 and 210 were filmed at the same time. And very rarely do we film chronologically, but this was a block where we filmed 209 almost completely out, and then we moved into 210 because of so much of the battle sequences. But we used many of the same extras here as we did in the next episode.
Now, what is this location? Because this is we used one location pretty much for this whole show.
We did. We went out to. Very rarely in the dialogue do we use actual location, but this was filmed just outside Crieff, and we say in dialogue that they're going to Crieff. We found a farm that had these outbuildings and with two big fields right next to them, and it was so we could set up the training right next to the outbuildings. And the idea was to go inside and outside as the weather permitted. Believe it or not, though, on this particular 7 day stretch or 8 days that we were there, it didn't rain very much. We had sunshine. It was very rare for us. But as you could see, as you're going through these outbuildings, there was just enough to house our main players, and then we can tent up the fields to give the appearance that there are 150 guys out there. And there you go. There's the sunshine.
Oh, and the scotch today is Glenfiddich 18.
18. Cheers. Cilantro. Oh, very smooth.
Oh, that's nice.
Welcome back to the boys.
There are the boys. Now it's Outlander.
Yes. And even Claire says it.
It really is a sense of homecoming to the first season. I mean, it's just so, you know, when Colm and Lyra showed up in 208, it definitely felt like, oh, yeah, we're back. We're back to that storyline. But you were missing these guys.
Yeah.
You were missing the knuckleheads and then Dougal.
we had a little bump in the road here. Willie, who was with us for much of the first season, he endeared himself to Claire and Jamie. The actor that played Willie, who we will not speak of, left us, so we had to find a way of finishing his story,
yes,
so to speak.
Yes, that was not a happy time.
It was.
I love that little throwaway line.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the early story of this episode. I don't think it's radically different from that. So we always said this was going to be the training episode, right?
Yes.
Jamie was going to train the men.
Yep.
Dougal would show up. And I think we played around with the Dougal story a couple of times. Was it always that he shows up and got demoted?
It wasn't that he was demoted. It was that he was going to have to adjust his expectations.
Right.
Dougal's always been a leader of men, a chieftain. And in this story, in his story going forward, he has to kind of kowtow to Jamie, who is now the leader of his own clan. And the iterations of how much and how much battle between the two
that's what
went
we
back
kept,
and forth.
That's what kept playing.
Yeah, we played that quite a bit. quite a bit. And it was tough to get it right, you know,
yeah.
to go, how much would, you know, there are normal debates in the room, is, you know, how much Dougal would take, how much Jamie would push, you know, all those things.
I'm trying to remember in the book, how does Dougal rejoin the story and where?
Dougal rejoins later.
It's later. Right?
We adjusted quite a bit of the timeline where things happened. 208 was quite a departure because that happens much later,
right,
in the
book.
That
was a whole different section.
That whole different section of the book. So in doing so, we stay true to history, though, believe it or not, is because they do come through this pass, and then they moved on to Perth, where they'll go first, and then they go into Edinburgh before they go in to Prestonpans, which we keep track of, and this would be the early or late summer of, if you have summer in Scotland, this would be the late summer of 45, to give a timeline, because we figured they spent approximately a month here training before they move to Prestonpans, where the end of this episode is literally the day before Prestonpans. So.
Now, we can't call it out shot by shot, but all through this episode, there's various places where we've digitally expanded the size of the encampment and the number of extras and soldiers. Like, I think some of those tents in the deep background there, we've added in visual effects. We've also doubled up on, you'll see Highlanders walking in the background of these shots. Sometimes those are digitally, it's called tiling, where you shoot a group of extras and then you multiply them through the backgrounds. Because even though this was a big production for us and a big number of extras, we still couldn't fill this enormous space without the digital help.
And that's always the challenge, is filling the space. And I think art department always does a really nice job, and costume as well, because we dress everybody all the way out. You know, we don't fake it just because they're three layers back.
Right.
You know, they're fully dressed. We can move them around anywhere we want. This was me channeling Full Metal Jacket. One of my favorite scenes of all time in any movie. And Duncan fully embraced it.
Yep. I just like the fact that we took some time to say, okay, why do we teach the guys to march at all? What's the point of teaching Highlanders how to fight like British redcoats? When, you know, there's this sort of myth that's grown up, especially in America, that, you know, we beat the British and the American Revolution because we hid behind trees and, you know, we fought like Indians, and the redcoats just got mowed down, and you think, oh god, they're idiots because they just marched in straight lines and that's how George Washington beat them. But of course that's not true at all.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have an opportunity to sort of, well, say actually there was a reason why they marched, and there's a reason why they did those things, and it wasn't just all silliness and pomp and circumstance.
Well, and they utilized the weapons they had. You know, and as we know, the muskets weren't very accurate, but when you throw out a wall of musket balls, you tend to hit something.
Yes.
And that's what the British knew, and they knew well. And that's what Jamie knows, And that's why he wants to retrain these guys. We're seeing little flashbacks here of... this is the departure from the book.
Yes.
Is that... well, I'll say... It's not quite... It's implied.
It's not contradictory. It doesn't contradict the book.
No. Certainly. It tells Claire's story that wasn't told in these first two books. And we just decided to tell it. And when we were in the room... We were discussing, we didn't want to see Claire preparing for battle because, one, that would be in the next episode, but we've also seen her, you know, fold bandages and get things ready. The thing that we really wanted to see is how, this is a war. They're going to go to war. We want to see how that World War II affected Claire.
Yeah, what was her story in this episode? Jamie's story is clear. He has men to train and he has a conflict with Dougal. What's Claire's story about? If it's just her prepping for battle, there's not really a character tale there. So we started kicking around the idea of, well, a version of PTSD for Claire, which they didn't even have a name for in her era. She wouldn't really know what it was, and no one really put that word on it, that phrase on it yet. And, okay, how would that manifest itself? And, oh, maybe as she watches Jamie preparing his men for battle, she starts remembering other young men that she saw before a battle. Exactly. And then, oh, well, what's the secret at the heart of that? Oh, there has to be a character thing. There has to be something that Claire has repressed or she doesn't want to think about that gives her a certain, you know, dramatic arc.
And what we'll come to at the end of her arc is that the difference between seeing men die is one thing, but seeing men that you know and love die is a totally different thing deal with.
And being helpless and not being able to affect that change. More pressing concerns are worrying about securing a seat at the
prince's table. I love how Jamie here in these scenes, he's trying to placate his uncle without putting him down, mm-hmm. without pissing on his position. But he knows he's overstepping. But I think France has taught Jamie how to be diplomatic in a lot of ways. This was a nugget that I'd always wanted to throw into a script somewhere. Is we know she heard Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ. We just didn't know where.
Yeah.
So I did a few liberties here to put it in. Diana, I think's okay with it.
Well, she said in the book, she definitely said in the book that Claire had heard it from an American soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just sort of saying, oh, okay, who's that American
soldier? Who's that soldier?
These guys were great. This was one of the few times I was on the location when they were shooting. I saw them shoot this scene.
Yeah, you were there that day.
The day is so windy. It was the night before, I think it had blown down some tents or something.
Yeah, we did lose some.
It's a miracle the sound is as good as it is. You can just look at it. You can see in the background, there's just constant wind blowing out there.
Yeah, it was the same. I think we filmed the baseball scene earlier, the little baseball flashback.
We don't know a lot, as I recall. The books don't tell us exactly where Claire went in her service in World War II. It's kind of vague.
Yeah.
So I remember in the production meeting saying it could be anywhere. You know, we didn't have to be tied into a particular place. Because, the truth of World War II is if Claire joined as early as she did and went out with the British Army, she could have been with the army in North Africa. She could have been there in Sicily. She could have been in Italy. We have settled on playing it as she's somewhere in France. After D-Day for this section of the story. So this is presumably... You know, she's with Montgomery's army, and they're in northern France and the Low Countries, and this is sometime in the summer of 1944.
Yeah, there's a mention of some place, and we slug lined it wherever they mention in the book, but we never actually say it in dialogue. So we do play it's just somewhere in France after D-Day.
In fact, there was what's the place that in season one, she's going to meet her relative, her cover story is...
Compiègne. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, maybe she was in Compiègne, but it didn't, it's like it actually didn't work out in terms of where the British actually were.
This scene, I like this scene because I like when Jamie and Claire kind of understand that, like couples that have been around each other for a long time, or even just get each other, understand when people aren't feeling, there's something wrong. They just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
He can't put his finger on it, But
he knows.
He knows. Something. And it's a good guess. It is. It's like, hey, this upcoming war, it's got to be bothering you, Claire.
Yeah.
He's just wrong about what war she's upset about.
Exactly.
Yeah. See, and like all husbands, I'm not one, but like all husbands know, or boyfriends, when a woman says she's fine, that's not the truth.
No. And you should usually walk away.
And Jamie's smart enough to turn his back and walk away.
Like, okay, I should stop this conversation now.
Yes.
We talked about Full Metal Jacket. We talked about Glory.
Too. Glory.
Glory was another
the brilliant
training,
movie.
Training episode, the training scenes in that film.
If anybody goes back and watches Glory or Full Metal Jacket, both those movies, the majority of the movies are the training.
Yeah.
It's the most important part of those movies. And bonding these characters together.
Yeah, making them soldiers.
Another great war story. Well, I mean, not great, but you know, I mean, in the sense of there is no great war, but a story well told is Band of Brothers, and they spent a lot of time on their training as well.
Yeah,
so
this was. I love this speech. I love Jamie. Yeah. I love Sam here. This is one of those key moments where you see the character take the next step.
Yeah,
you know, you've seen him go all the way from the stable boy to the husband, to the politician, to the warrior, and now the leader of men.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like you always knew that men liked looked up to Jamie and would follow him, but now can he command an army? Can he command the loyalty of men in a desperate fight? And this is that moment. I think Sam does a really great job with this.
I think he does as well. I think the nice thing that he does is he draws them in with his sly sense of humor at the beginning of the speech,
mm-hmm.
and he gets their attention with that, and then he turns it on him.
Yeah.
And says, "I know you think this isn't serious,
yeah.
but it is. And I've seen it. And at the end of this, I would follow him into battle.
Yeah.
That's the key to it. Is would you follow Jamie Fraser into battle? And the answer is absolutely yes. Raise their muskets. Aim. And let loose. It doesn't hurt that he's wearing a badass leather jacket.
Yeah, he's looking
too.
Pretty badass. Yeah. It was a fearsome thing, these volleys of musket balls. I mean, the Brown Bess, the musket at the time that the British used, wasn't a particularly accurate weapon. It didn't have a rifled barrel, so it was a smoothbore musket that, you know, was fairly inaccurate beyond a certain range. But if you line them all up together and fired them all at once, you had like a sheet of steel going across a battlefield, and you didn't want to stand in front of that. And the British Army was a fearsome military force in these days.
Well, that was one thing you had always spoke of early on to all the writers, and you said, and I remember it was, the British Army didn't rule over the most of the known world, and were dumb.
Yeah,
you know, you would never allow us to have stupid characters.
No,
because they just weren't.
They weren't.
And this was we went round and round about this. One, I love that Jamie yells at them to stand. The costuming on this was always a fun issue. We had meetings and meetings about it. It was originally scripted they come out naked because that's the way they would do it.
The way they fought. In battle, they actually dropped their kilts.
Everything.
And ran, you know, without them because the kilts kind of impeded their movement.
They
right?
did, exactly. And it also put the fear of God in. To be anybody who would fight completely naked must be insane. is we decided to do just the shirts, but they look like, as Terry said, they look like guys wearing, you know, long johns. So yeah. We went with this version, which I think looks great. I mean, it ended up looking really good. But this is, I love this moment here. He asks for a word, but he's really demanding a word.
They play so well together.
They do.
They really have a great chemistry.
They do. They match up. I would have flipped the blocking on this, as I would have had Jamie up the hill. But we all have our little peeves about certain things.
Yeah.
But they are very strong together, aren't they? I mean,
they're
just
really
watching them in scenes together.
I came with these men will face, and I know how to prepare them for it. You don't.
One of my favorites is that Jamie finally calls Dougal out on, you pretending to be a soldier? I have been a soldier.
Well, and this goes to the heart of what you were talking about a minute ago. Dougal does not respect his enemy. Dougal thinks of the Redcoats as fops and silly and easily defeated by the heart and soul of Highlander ferocity. And Jamie's a soldier, and he's seen those battle lines, and he knows what a British army can really do, and he respects that. And that's the key. And I think that's important for the show, because I think ultimately, you know, a lot of times, you know, the Redcoats of the era in various productions are just portrayed as silly, they're foppish, they're aristocratic, and they hold up their nose and they act in certain ways, and they're straw men that you can knock down. And the truth was, they were kind of scary, you know, scary opponents you didn't really want to face on a field of battle.
This scene was, I agree with that 100%, and I think we did that nicely in episode 6 of last year, where we turned Lord Thomas could have been that fight, but there was turns where you go, oh, he's smarter
he had
than
teeth. And you're like, wait a minute.
This is a callback to episode 14 where they had their bargain in the cave, and we discussed in the room that we had to call back. It would be odd that they would never have a conversation about it. And it also shows that Dougal's a manipulator.
Yep.
He's a schemer. He's always got the next plan out there.
Well, and you definitely wanted to have another Claire-Dougal scene, because they were great together.
This
scene floated around a bit. And this is not where it was actually scripted or shot, because this scene, there's a sequence coming up later where Jamie takes the beating, right? And as scripted and as shot, Dougal administered the beating.
He administers it. We did end up cutting that.
We ended up cutting it. But this was going to take place after that scene, originally. That's how it was scripted. But in the cut, it felt odd. Like, it's always interesting when you write something on the page and then you see it, it affects you. It's really, you're doing, someone told me a long time ago, you do your second draft of the script in the editing room.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true. Because when you watched it, this scene felt out of place where we had it, even though it felt right in the script. So then, in editing, we kept moving this around. This scene kept floating and finding different spots.
Actually, we kept talking about, where does it fit in Claire's story?
Yeah, where does it fit in
Claire's story?
Because this is a Claire scene, really.
Yes.
And this felt like the best spot for it. And fortunately, it's the nature of this show is that she's wearing the same outfit and he's wearing the same outfit, and it's still a daylight scene, so we could actually kind of mix and match it a bit. And it affects her story differently, because where it used to be, after the beating, Claire's story had already ended. She had already made the turn. She had already realized. She had already gone through the whole memory sequence of her PTSD and decided to stay with them. And it had a different meaning then than it does now. Now it's at the beginning of her story, and she hasn't had that revelation yet.
I think in the script, it's closer to here. And we flipped it in post, the first cut, farther down.
Yeah.
And then we moved it up a little bit. And then we moved it up a little bit.
Yeah,
and then we kept moving it.
And then found this.
And then found
the
this
happy
spot.
Point.
I'll try my damnedest. Fuck yourself.
Now, even though we went round and round, Dougal wouldn't know what the word meant because he hadn't heard it a lot.
Yeah.
He got the tone.
He got it.
Yeah.
It was clear enough in context.
And the thing is Dougal's an educated man. He knows narcissists, he knows the story. And that's why it felt, for me, it felt right f-
for him to hear it.
Yeah.
He was like, I understand what you're saying, Missy, but let me point this out to you. We weren't going to let Dougal walk away with his tail between his
legs.
Yeah,
he couldn't be chastened.
Yeah. So they both, the turn for both of them are, because I always also imagine, because we never show it, but I imagine Claire, because they do share things, would have said to Jamie, hey, by the way, to get you out of Wentworth, I made this bargain. I would never have gone through with it. But, and he would have laughed.
Yeah.
It. Like, no, good deal. Yeah, that was smart.
Of course I would have. I love, just a side note on the score of this episode, I think is one of our best. I love the men's chorus, which I think, if my memory serves correct, came out of a discussion with Bear and I about, I think I said something about the Red Army chorus in some other piece. I think we were talking about Hunt for Red October.
Yes.
I said something about...
Yes, when they sing in...
Red October, yes. And I think Bear went, oh, and I think it sparked something, and then he brought in this men's chorus, which is wonderful.
I loved it. It really ties the, and it takes the training from this generic training to something elevated.
Yeah. It's a good example of the way the score can enhance and elevate the story. And I think one of Bear's great gifts is that I think he scores the show in a way that brings out a lot of other colors without distracting you. Like, I'm never watching the show or any of Bear's shows and suddenly find myself going, oh, wow, that's an interesting musical thing, and taking me out of the scene, just listening to the melody. He knows how to, like, make it enhance what you're doing, or sometimes bring in a different color, but it never takes you out of the show.
Well, I think that's the thing. We were talking about this when we were doing the playback for 213, is that's exactly it. It's almost like if you hear the music, it's doing something wrong.
Yeah.
You should feel the music.
You should feel the music.
And I think that's Bear's goal, is you always should feel the music. Yeah. Yeah.
It's sort of like visual effect.
It is.
If you're aware of the visual effect, then it's not a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trenchfoot can lead to gangrene, which can lead to amputation. I've seen it happen.
I'm trying to remember, was this Ira's idea? We were weren't we hunting for something that would be a problem in the 18th century and also a problem in World War II? Where did this come from?
No, this came from I did it with the trench foot because of the EMT background, so I was...
Oh, like, this came from you,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So we wanted to tie it in because one of the biggest causes of military men going, you know, getting sent off the lines was their feet.
Yeah.
They had to protect their feet. And Claire would have known that. And the Highlanders would never even thought about it. So we wanted to kind of tie that together.
Are you listening?
And this was actually your idea to do the little flashes that...
Oh, yeah.
The flashes, he's there, he's not there. And we actually filmed it. It doesn't necessarily show up, but we filmed it where we put the GI in this spot.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't use it in the cut, but he was there. And I like that she's having trouble here. We just didn't kind of wash over the fact that she went through a world war.
Yeah.
Where millions died, and it wouldn't have affected her, because we see people nowadays coming back with PTSD from the battles in Afghanistan and Iraq and all the places that they go now, and they're affected deeply, and their families are affected. So
she says to be
in this is the way we wanted to kind of play homage to that.
Yeah, you need to
way.
Acknowledge the reality of that it affects people deeply long after the battle is over. And even for the people that weren't in the battle but dealt with the trauma of the aftermath of the battle, like Claire.
My brother, who's a firefighter paramedic and who's been doing it for many, many, many years, you know, you have to have a constitution that's built up to where you can put that aside and still live a daily life, you know, whether police officer, firefighter, or soldier, you know. You're dealing with battles all the time. So Claire is a trauma nurse. Would have had to have dealt with it, I think. You know, she would have had to have, she saw so much.
Is it the kind of thing you know on day one, whether you can do this or not?
To me, it took me 4 years to figure out, this isn't my build.
But you did it for 4 years.
Yeah, I did. I think that
Yes, there were a lot of people that got weeded out very first. Yes, very quickly. And you could just see it in their face. It's that doe-eyed look, that thousand-eyed stare, and you go, this was your first, this is your first call. It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
And this is, might not be for you.
Yeah.
And I think probably going into battle, it's probably very similar where they find out, God, I don't want this guy next to me, you know, where
this is not going to
be good. Prepare to fight and die for their true king. I much prefer they fight and live for their king. And I think that line right there tells the difference between Dougal and Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie's concerned with what happens afterwards.
Yeah.
And Dougal's just about the now.
It's a smarter strategy. You want them to live. You want them to fight the next battle.
Yes.
You don't want them to die.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember, did we ever... I have a vague memory of us actually following Dougal into the village and watching him recruit these guys at one point.
We talked about doing it, we never actually did.
We didn't write that version,
no,
right?
We broke it in the room. We wanted to see him do it.
Or he would have gone to the village and basically shanghaied these guys.
Shanghaied them, exactly. Great word. I love that word, shanghaied. Speaking of, that might happen, I don't know, in season 3.
You never know.
Stay
tuned.
Oh, our fans won't stay tuned. We need every able-bodied man. They drift off, our fans.
That's right. Not leave another client's men. I'll not force a man to risk dying for something he does not believe in. You and I can make them believe. No. We cannot.
And I think that's the heart of Jamie. Being flogged, you know, 200 times. It's like, we want you to think like us. So he can speak to this. I'm not gonna force someone to believe something.
Yeah, because you can't.
Exactly.
They either believe it or they don't.
Exactly.
Now, this is a location, right?
Yes. So once again, these are all these outbuildings that we were able to use and go in and out of repeatedly. Weather permitting, and daylight permitting.
Is it, in fact...
Oh, wait, no.
Is
sorry.
This interior?
This is actually interior stage.
It is. Okay.
It is, because we added the tree. Gary built, and the art department built a really good location. This is the same place where they'll bring John Gray later.
I mean, it's a testament to the fact that you can't tell the difference.
Well, when we watch is like, oh, wait, is this the location?
Yeah.
And, you know, the art department does that. They do that so often. That it's remember that old, what was it? Is it Live or Memorex?
Live or Memorex?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's Gary.
Yeah,
Is it real? Now, this is a scene that... wasn't originally scripted in the writer's draft, and after reading the draft, we all agreed we should see this to know what's coming.
Yeah, to set it up.
Yeah,
and I think it's really interesting in sort of the overall of the show that, you know, a big chunk of season one is all about Jamie being flogged and the brutality of that and the brutality of the time, and so when our hero, who's endured that himself, orders that as punishment for his men, it tells you a lot about the times that they live in, and even his perspective on his own beatings and what was the line, and that they're, in Jamie's mind, there are legitimate beatings and there are illegitimate beatings.
Right. And I think for Jamie, and for me, when I deal with this character, it's always, he's coming at it from the righteous place, is that there's a reason we're
absolutely
doing this. I'm not just doing it gratuitously just to punish you.
This is not sadism.
This is a lesson learned. You need to learn a lesson here.
Yes.
And sometimes there's a line from season one where he says, knowing it and understanding it are two different things.
Yeah. Again, I love Katrina in this whole little section.
And I like that Jamie's paying attention.
Yep.
He's like, the one thing that's more important than anything in this world is his wife. And he had to acknowledge that. You were
I was here for this.
You were here for this.
This was this one long day I was on the set.
Yeah.
This was fun.
It was fun. We did a second unit shoot. We're blowing things up. By the way, when Ron sees blowing things up on the call sheet, he's going to definitely show up that day.
It's like, oh, we're blowing things, we're blowing shit up today. I think I'll go to the set.
Yeah. By the way, all that was practical. We used real squibs and real explosions. It was our special effects team, which is different than the visual effects team, are brilliant. They do a really, really good job.
And this is just, you know, this is not the Battle of the Bulge. This is just some minor skirmish. This is just a moment when the Germans advanced and they got caught on the wrong side for, you know, for a night, which is stuff that happened all the time.
I mean, all the time.
Just little, it's little things that happen along the battlefront, not the major battles. And, you know, life and death and, you know, tragedies happen all through the war. That's a real Amtrak that David Brown, I remember when we were in the production meeting, we were talking about, well, I'd like some German uniforms and this and that. And David Brown piped up and said, I can get you a tank.
Yeah.
And we said, sold. And he was like, really, a tank? And he's like, oh, yes, no problem at all.
I think David actually wanted to be one of the
I think he wanted to be one of the
one of the soldiers. And we're like, I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah, there was talk of, I remember at one point, somebody said, and you can drive the tank, Ron, if you want. And I was like, really? And of course, I can't drive the tank. No one will let you.
But you were tempted.
I was tempted.
That's
the key. I can drive the tank?
Yeah.
How cool would that be?
There are certain perks that come along with the job, and driving tanks would be one of them.
I love this little story. I just love that our heroine can't get out of the ditch, that he's dying out there, he's crying, he needs help, she's the nurse. But she'll die if she does it, and the smart move is not to do it.
And the thing is, this isn't a grown woman. This is a 19, 20-year-old woman.
This is a very young woman.
Yeah. The transition for this was, I think, really important.
What the hell are you doing down here all alone? Are you okay? Bill?
Are you done?
That
I love that.
That little
that
bead.
That little bead.
Yeah.
There was a version of this moment I remember we talking about in the writer's room where Claire would have actually left.
Yes.
And started heading back to Lollybrook. Yeah. And then there was, I can't remember what made her turn back. There was something that happened to her on the road, or she had an epiphany on the road, and then she was going to turn back, right?
We had talked, it wasn't even boarded. We just talked about it.
We just talked about it.
Yeah. That's the thing about, if we shot everything we talked about, we would still be shooting season, we'd still be shooting the first episode of season one.
That's right.
But that's what we do. We talk things out, and that's what's so great about the writer's room process.
That's how I, you know, it's interesting when I watch the show, and it's like that through a lot of shows, even like Battlestar or Trek to some extent, as my memory fades. When I watch episodes I've worked on, whether I wrote them or not, a lot of me as I'm watching is remembering alternate paths that were discussed. And so there's this sort of missing limb quality to the show when I watch it. You're sort of constantly aware of all the roads that were not traveled and all the possibilities. And they kind of inform my viewing of the show, which is then makes it so fundamentally different than the audience's, you know, view of the show.
It's true. I mean, and I think what we do is we present a story or a path and we throw rocks at it, continually just throw rocks at it until we go, this is the path we should go, you know, and as you always say, the best idea should win, you know.
Yeah, and the best idea was not that her going down the road and then deciding to turn back, because it was sort of a big, like, well, that was about nothing.
Well, that was about nothing because this is the moment.
This is the moment.
Is where she's with Jamie and they make the decision together in a way.
Yeah, so hopefully the process of working through the script and the story outline and the writer's room is you find that. You find all the ideas. Oh, well, actually, the dramatic high point is here.
Yeah.
This is really what the focus should be. Because unlike in a book where you have many, many pages,
yeah.
you only have 60 minutes. And you've got to choose your moments carefully because each moment lands, each moment has meaning to the audience in a different way than it does on the page. And if we had left this scene and she had gotten on a horse and left, now we've got another whole journey. It's like you're starting a new story. Then there has to be a new story, the story of Claire on the road.
Yes.
And how she makes the decision to turn back and then rejoining with Jamie and how Jamie receives that. Suddenly, it's like 10 minutes go by.
Exactly. But 10 minutes of screen time, just to give everybody a little indication, is for every one day we film, you get about maybe 4 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, maybe.
So you're talking 10 minutes, you know, that's almost 3 days.
Yeah, we're going to spend 3 days of watching her basically do a loop where she just comes back to where she started.
Exactly.
And she could just decide to do it in that scene.
Well, welcome, Lord John
Gregg. Hello, Lord John Gregg. So, big moment for book readers. They know who this character is and where he's going. This was key. We had to include this in the script because this is a major character that will carry through in subsequent seasons.
And, 9 was always going to be that script, and it was actually seamlessly working this into the other stories,
yeah,
and having it fit.
Yeah, where does this happen?
Where does this happen? How does this happen? In the book, it happens in a slightly different way. They're outside.
Yeah.
We had inside quarters. You have to make adjustments accordingly.
I think some of this dialogue is definitely drawn from the book.
Oh, absolutely. You try to, absolutely, when it works, you use it. The difference here is we had the story of Claire going through PTSD.
Right.
She was emotional. She was, and in the book, Jamie takes essentially advantage of Claire and rips her bodice off and without her knowledge. And when we
and
were in
pretends
the
to
and
ravish
pretends
her.
To ravish her, and when we were in the room, we just couldn't reconcile the fact that Jamie would do that after the scene we just saw. So the adjustment is that Claire basically consents to it with her eyes, and the fact that
she comes up with it.
She
in
comes,
this version.
Yeah, and the Jamie reads it very quickly, and he takes over, and he takes it to a new level. And I like that Jamie just doesn't play it. He really plays.
He really plays.
And he gets actually aggressive with her.
And what I like is the interplay between the two of them.
Yes.
Because as he gets aggressive, she starts really actually jabbing him.
Yes.
And then he reacts to her. So there's like two levels of this going on.
Like, hey, I said it was okay, but...
God, I didn't mean it like that.
Yeah.
Scottish barbarian.
My favorite line.
Scottish barbarian.
Where she calls him a pig. That's where Jamie knows.
She's like, oh, okay. Which is actually set up pretty well by us in terms of, you know, in 208, she pretended to be the witch thing. So Jamie is starting to get quick to the fact that Claire comes up with these crazy plans in the spur of the moment.
And one of the points when we were filming was Jamie needs to take this to a new level. He knows he needs to take it to a new level, so Gray believes it.
To convince this kid.
And Claire didn't consent to that.
And
that's the part that I like, is that Claire didn't consent to having him really go all out.
Release the lady, then. I will tell you whatever you wish.
And that, even that, hold her.
Yeah. And he steals a kiss.
And he steals a kiss.
Yeah. And she's like, yeah, you'll be paying for that.
You're going to pay for that.
My name is William Gray. Second son, Viscount Melton.
And what are the troops you're with?
200 infantry, travelling to Dunbar to join General Cope's army. And I warn you, we have heavy armament. 16 carriage-mounted cannon, mortars and muskets. Company of 30 cavalry.
Much obliged for the warning. And where are these men you speak of present?
It comes from 3 miles to the west.
Take this man and direction he says the camp lies. If the information he gave us proves true, tie him to a tree 1 mile from the camp. His friends will find him there tomorrow. If what he told us is not true, then cut his throat.
Gladly.
I do like that Jamie does give that order.
Yeah.
Like, he actually will kill this guy if it's all false.
That's, he's, I really love when we play Jamie as a man of his times.
Yeah.
That he is a modern thinker, and he does,
I should hope to discharge that debt in the future.
But when he plays him, when we play him as a man of his time, I'll have to kill this guy.
Yeah. And you believe it. You believe he'll do it.
Yep.
Because that is who he is.
And even this beat right here is that the time your word was your bond.
Yeah.
What you said meant everything.
It means a very great deal.
Yeah. So this is the kind of the callback to that first scene.
Yep.
Is Jamie saying who the guilty needs to be punished?
Those men let the boy get through the lines. Can't continue with this carelessness.
And you set up, you know, it's a nice setup. You feel like they're going to beat Dougal, and how's he going to take it?
Yeah, in the script, Dougal actually has to do the beating. We adjusted this in the cut to give Dougal his moment later.
Because it kind of felt like we were doubling up on it.
Yeah.
It's like it was one thing here when they forced Dougal to then beat Jamie, and all the men looked at him and hated him. But then we sort of have almost the equivalent moment coming up where Dougal has to stay behind while they go on the raid.
Yeah.
And then when you watched them together, you realize it was a double pump.
It was a double pump.
So then we changed this. We just re-edited this so that you never see Dougal have to administer it, and that it's implied that it's Murtaugh.
But it also, it feels right that Jamie's, in a way that he took Leary's punishment in episode 2, he's taking Dougal's punishment in this episode, which is even worse. When someone else takes your punishment,
it's
even worse.
It works really well.
Yeah. And thankfully Graham played it that way.
And, so you never actually see Murtaugh.
Yeah, you never see who's actually, through the brilliance of editing,
yes,
is that...
you can imagine that it's Murtaugh.
And that was a stolen shot from earlier.
Yep.
Yeah. But this is the real punishment, is you have to stay behind.
Yeah. He has to suck it up, he has to do it, and he has to sort of pretend like he likes it.
No idea. Not you. You've not been here. Century to do. You still have a camp to protect. I stay behind. I'm like some wretched soldier. Must be given an order by his commander.
Which is the key.
Yep. Which Dougal actually has to understand.
Yeah.
And that's his arc.
That's the arc.
Yeah. And I think Dougal has to accept that because he wants to fight this battle.
Yep.
And to do so, he knows he can't just join any other clan.
This little scene, we went back and shot some pickup shots to sort of enhance this, to sort of make it a little bit more of a raid. I always think of this in my mind as the Alamo raid, because it reminds me of a sequence in John Wayne's version of the Alamo where they go and they sabotage this cannon that the Mexican army was going to batter down the walls of the Alamo with. And so I always think of this as the Alamo scene.
You know, what sets this up nicely is episode 4, when we take the pins out of the carriage.
in the original cut, we didn't see them burning the wagon wheels.
No.
And then we sort of realized you kind of had to see them burning the wagon wheels to sort of understand.
It was in the original script.
Yeah, the oldest. That's right.
Yeah, we cut it out first.
Because you make these decisions. You're like, oh, we don't need that. Let's cut that out for time or money.
Like, oh, you're going to need that.
And then later it's, oh, go back. And you shot that, right? You shot the wagon wheel burning on like 2 feet of set?
2 feet of set. I like this little moment where a soldier comes back from essentially battle with his trophies of war.
Yeah.
He uses the word commando.
Yeah, commando.
Yeah.
You went to the British camp. Did you go by yourself?
Also, what a soldier would do, you don't tell your wife when you're going to go do dangerous stuff.
I love that her instinct is, did you go by yourself?
Exactly.
You're that big of an idiot that you would really do that?
Look how proud he is. I love that. He's so like proud. So proud of her. In the book, they're in a tent, and they open up. He opens up the tent and shows that they're burning. Obviously, we're not in a tent, so we had to adjust, but yeah. This is my kind of favorite moment when.
You should get dressed. That's not what I expected you to do.
The flip.
Yeah.
As much as I want you, Sasha, let's be off. Mrs. Camp will be waiting.
Yeah, he's cognizant of the fact that, hey, we just did this thing. If we don't leave.
Should probably get going about now.
As much as I want to have sex here. Here's your, what you were talking about earlier. Yeah. And over this, I mean, it just really, it feels just right, doesn't it?
It's great. Yeah. It's the exact right piece of score here.
I see from the original, the beginning where they were all ragtag group, Jamie's got them walking in columns. They're moving as a team, come over this ridge on a glorious Scottish day, by the way.
I know. It's like
I know you hear us talking about it raining all the time. This is not real.
No.
I mean, it's real, but...
Yeah, we enhance this significantly.
In here...
Right ahead. And announce our presence to His Royal Highness. It's Charles Edward.
And that's a true leader.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to take, all the credit. He doesn't have to take everything. He gives it to the person, though. If he gives it to Dougal, Dougal's loyalty will come back to him tenfold.
And Dougal's submission allows this moment to, to happen.
And then Claire's saying she's ready. Whether she likes it or not, she's ready.
Whether she likes it or not.
Here we go, on to Press the Pens.
Here we go. It's a great episode. Oh. I think it's a really good episode. You did a great job with it.
Thanks. You know, I mean, it's a massive team that brings this to the screen, and congratulations to everybody.
To everybody.
Really, it's big, and as I always say that, you know, what one sentence in the book is 3 days shooting for
it's
us.
It's a lot of work.
You know, it's a lot of work. So we try to give everybody everything. We know we can't, but we do the best we can.
Best we can.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for joining us, and we will talk to you again soon for episode 210. Until then, I'm Ron.
I'm Matt.
And good night and good luck.
Yep.